Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Tim Powers with Deep Dish Radio. How you doing? Thanks for checking us out today. My guest today is author Patty Farmer, who has written a book called Playboy Laughs, The Comedy, Comedians, and Cartoons of Playboy, and it is available wherever you get your books. Now, Playboy Laughs is a look at how the magazine and industry surrounding the magazine Playboy shaped the American comedy culture. Really, it takes a look at the comedy goings-on at the Playboy clubs through the Hef's TV shows, the Playboy Penthouse and Playboy After Dark, and also the comedy that went into the Playboy magazine. Now, you know, to the outsider, you would think that this kind of comedy would be awful sophomoric, and it's not. The talent that came through these clubs, the talent that came through the TV shows, and the skill of the cartoonists from Jack Cole and Al Jaffe, you know, the guy that created Plastic Man and the geniuses behind Mad Magazine, all, you know, all worked for Playboy. And the comedy that that started in, you know, in the 50s with Playboy and carried through the 60s and carried through the 70s is still alive and well today. And it's really a fascinating look at what Hef has created. We'll talk to Patty in just a little bit. I am pleased to announce that Deep Dish Radio has a Facebook page. And if you'd like to interact with me, if you'd like to join up and get the first heads up on new episodes, if you'd like to suggest guests, I would love to hear from you. So head over to your Facebook account and check out Deep Dish Radio with Tim Powers. I have my own page in there, and I'd love to hear from you. We're also on Twitter, at Deep Dish Radio, and you can also email me directly, tim@deepdishradio, and I would love to hear from you. So, Patty, wow. What a charming and smart and sparkling lady who really, her passion for what she does is really, really tangible in this interview. And this book, which I loved, by the way, is meticulously researched. She spoke with legends of comedy and with entertainment. And it's a front row seat, really, at some of the most exciting things that happened in comedy and set the stage for where we are today. Also, if you're a fan of cartooning, you will not want to miss the stories in this book. But don't take my word for it. Let's take a second and let's meet Patty Farmer. So, Patty, welcome to Deep Dish Radio. It is it's a pleasure to have you. And as I told you before we started rolling, I love this book and love even the theory behind it. So I wanted to ask before we got started, tell me why you felt the story of comedy and comedians and the humor of the Playboy lifestyle needed to be told.
Good morning, Tim, first of all, and thank you for having me.
Sure.
But this story, amazingly, hasn't been told. There are complete books on Hugh Hefner and the mansion and the girls next door and, you know, on and on. Pick one area of Playboy, even golf tournaments that were sponsored by Playboy. There's a book on that.
Wow.
But to my unbelievable surprise, there has never been a book about the number one impact that Playboy made towards entertainment, you know, musicians and singers, and especially comedy. So I, being a entertainment historian, just had to delve into it. And the more I peeled back that onion, the more I found, and the deeper that well became, you know, the impact on civil rights that Hefner provided, and
right.
just the cultural contributions. It was fascinating.
Yeah, one of the things that really shines through in the book, and you know, and there's a lot in this book. One of the things that really shines through is how progressive Hef was in civil rights, in equality, in really in business. You know, as well, he gets a lot of credit for kickstarting the sexual revolution, which may or may not be fair. He is certainly right on the front lines of it. But there are so many other things that he did and so many careers that he advanced just because he was a progressive and open-minded thinker in a culture that wasn't necessarily that open-minded yet.
You're absolutely right, Tim. We're talking the Playboy Club's first opened 1960, and his TV show was 1959, and these were all before the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and I think it's fair to say that you and I really didn't live through that time, and we didn't know what that was like to live in segregated America. But I went back and spoke with a lot of these entertainers who, you know, if you were a black comedian, you performed in front of black audiences, and it was a segregated America. So Hugh Hefner just paid no attention to that. And not only did he not pay attention to that, I think he was actually colorblind to that, because he was always shocked when there was blowback, and there was a lot of blowback. He had Nat King Cole on his TV show, 1959, he had Nat King Cole come out and talk to Hef, and then he went and sat down with Rona Jaffe, who is a white author.
Right.
No big deal. You know, you're probably yawning at your end saying, you know, what's the big deal here? But the next day, the networks went crazy, and the sponsors threatened to pull advertising because Hefner had dared show a black man talking literature with a white woman. You know, that was the time. So Hefner never said, well, we're going to do this and we're going to get a lot of great publicity out of it. You know, he was always surprised, but he always just kept doing what he was doing. And somebody told me, one of the performers told me, you know, Hefner didn't care if you were black, white, or purple, only if you could sing a song, swing an instrument, or tell a joke. And I think that carried through on all the Playboy platforms. He had the very best people.
You know, he really did. And there's so much great comedy involved in the Playboy enterprise. I got to tell you, as most young men of my generation, you know, we discovered girls through Playboy, but there were a select few of us, and I've had this conversation with several other comedians my age, that, you know, when we found, you know, Uncle Dave's Playboys or whatever, we wouldn't go to the centerfold first. we'd go to the joke page and go, this is brilliant.
And I knew you were going to say that.
Well, how many times did you hear that story?
A lot.
Tell me more.
Just a lot. You know, people said they either went to the joke page or they went to the cartoon page. And that was, you know, the draw. And I think that was the beauty of Playboy, really. There had been tons of men's magazines before Playboy.
Right.
And, you know, people think Playboy invented it all, but really the 40s and the 50s, they had some really raunchy men's magazines. And Hef made a different kind of magazine. It was something for everybody. You know, of course it had the centerfolds and you know, racy articles, but it also had covered music, and Hefner loved comedy. So it had, like you said, the jokes page, and it had great cartoons.
Right. And I mean, one of the best interviews Lenny Bruce ever gave was his Playboy interview, which has been republished a zillion times over. But if you go through the acts that, you know, that made the Playboy Club their home, it's twofold, from what I understand. It's the old guard trying out new material and staying in front of the audience. So you've got your Milton Berles and you know, your Shecky Greens and guys like that, who by all means master comedians, no question, and I would never say that their star ever faded, but in order to stay in front of an audience, the Playboy Club was important to them. But at the same time, you got the up and coming guys that you think of, you know, around that time. Carlin, after he broke with Jack Burns. You know, gosh, the late great Dick Gregory that we lost last night. Dreesen and Tim Reed.
Who... Right. You had decades, you know, really decades. And the great people that became great comedians, you know, so you had... like you were saying, the earlier comedians, the Irwin Coreys and the Dick Gregorys.
Oh, those guys.
And then you also had like the Lettermans and the Lenos and Seinfelds and Steve Martin and Billy Crystal. Whether they like to admit it or not, they were all there because it provided a stage for them and a paycheck before the comedy clubs of the 70s opened.
And sweet, sweet booking gigs. I mean, I'm reading this as a comedian going, 40 weeks to travel coast to coast doing Playboy clubs and getting paid handsomely and eating very well is something a road comic just would love to do. A 40-week booking for, you know, a 30-minute act is, you know, we'd all punch our moms in the face for that. That's...
And the eye candy wasn't too bad either, right?
No, that's true. We've had... another Playboy bunny on the show, Catherine Lee Scott from Dark Shadows, who I actually told her about your book, and she's like, "Oh, I talked to Patty once on the phone, and I had to connect you guys." She's got an interesting ringside perspective on a lot of that stuff as well. But yes, by all means, young up and coming comedians surrounded by the eye candy in the club certainly didn't hurt at all. And you know, one of the most fascinating stories I think goes back to the civil rights, and it's the Tim and Tom story about Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen and their partnership. Most people know them as separate entities now, but you know, when they were a comedy team, they were America's first black and white comedy team. And half the audience, you know, people didn't laughing at the other half of the jokes. Can you tell me a little bit about how Playboy affected them and vice versa?
Well, again, it gave them a place to work and perform or perfect their acts. And just like you said, they ran into a lot of adversity, you know, and hecklers. And I think for both of them, it really honed their method of dealing with it. So even when they were out on their own and Dreesen was opening for Sinatra, you know, that training, you know, got him where he was going. And of course, Tim Reed went on to TV.
Right.
And, you know, WKRP in Cincinnati and just many other shows and comedy also. But those early years were priceless for comedians, even people like Joan Rivers, you duo, but also studio.
Yep.
At Playboy, she was Jim, Jake, and Joan. So you had all these comedians. A lot of them did hone their act there, worked on their timing, figured out what it was like to work next level audience. But there were four they moved of comedians that just, you know, for 10 years worked that 40-week gig at Playboy. You know, worked for Playboy for 10 years. I spoke to Jerry Van Dyke.
Wow.
He worked there for a lot of years. And he said, you know, he just would kiss Hugh Hefner on the mouth if he had the opportunity. because it kept him in comedy. He didn't have to become a car salesman, you know, to support the family.
Right.
You know, he got a check, and eventually he was discovered. Earl Wilson went to a Playboy Club and wrote about him, and he moved up to whatever, My Father the Car, or whatever that was.
Yeah.
You know, moved up to the next step. But there are a lot of comedians that just worked for the Playboy Club for years and years. And like you mentioned, you had the headliners, the Milton Berle, Greens, and Rich. A lot of, you know, starting out people got discovered there. You know, Flip Wilson, Carson used to come really as a almost like a casting call who was up and coming. And Flip Wilson got discovered there on the music side.
Right.
Al Jarreau, you know, the, what, 9-time Grammy winner, used to be part of a duo called, got discovered by Johnny Carson at the club. So you had all these great people, you know, different decades and different generations of the greats.
All mashed up. And to be clear, it wasn't just stand-up comedy that really owes a big debt to the Playboy Clubs, but the Chicago Club, for a while, was home to Second City.
Mm-hmm.
And the comedy went on to become from basically the comedy scene that people know today, your Saturday Night Lives and your Mad TVs and the improv phenomenon that is going through the theater community right now. And a lot of that thinking direct comedy / even theater to a degree.
Great.
Wow.
I think Playboy provided that bridge fashion of the 50s. And like we talked about, the comedy clubs and improvs that popped up in the 70s. Live, you know, it kept melodramatic in saying that, but I really think it kept comedy out there and fostered all the new generations. You know, the Jimmy Walkers and David Brenners that were coming up in the 70s.
Right. And, you know, most of America's exposure to these comedians was pretty sanitized on, you know, your Merv Griffin shows or your Mike Douglas shows or even Carson, where you could get a little bit risque. And before there was cable TV where you could speak freely, you know, the Playboy Club offered a place for these comedians to think freely and to speak freely and really, you know, exercise that right that comedians have right now to say literally what's on their minds without really holding back. And it's mm-hmm. interesting to see how that has come as a result of just, you know, a forward-thinking publisher and businessman.
Definitely.
You know,
Hess, while at the clubs and on the TV show, he wanted to keep it clean. You know, he really didn't like cursing on the shows.
Right.
But he was progressive in thinking. He had the Mort Sahls with the political humor, you know, that was coming. That was new at that time. You know, it evolved into something we just take for granted. But you had those sick comics.
Right.
You know, the Mort Sahls and the Lenny Bruces. And Shelley Berman's, and I don't know how Bob Newhart got into that category, but
I think by virtue of chronology, he kind of falls in there. But yeah, there's this whole, and you even reference it in your book. There's this there's a whole renaissance of comedy in the late 50s and early 60s, where it goes from mother-in-law jokes into political commentary, and a lot of it switched with the Kennedy assassination and just all these things converging at once. You know, popular music is changing, popular culture is changing, the publishing world is changing, people's thoughts are changing, and that's reflected in the comedy, and you absolutely see that reflected through the comedy in the Playboy Clubs, but also parallel with the comedians. You know, you do a whole chapter on female comedians.
Right.
And which even today, for whatever reason, today that's considered, a progressive thing. And when there are comedy shows, it's like, hey, come and see the women's comedy show, instead of just these are comedians who also just happen to have lady parts.
Right, right. You know, the chick comic, but,
right.
You know, Hefner, again, on the TV show back in the late 50s, he had Phyllis Diller on. And not only was she a woman, she was a middle-aged woman that was starting out into comedy. But, you know, she was funnier than heck. And, you know, Hef championed her. And, of course, you know, the generations that came after, not really generations that came after, but the girls that came after, you know, the Kay Ballards and the Lily Tomlins and Joan Rivers, those folks, he gave them a stage. And from what people told me, and the stories are in the books, you know, Joan Rivers was not cracked out of a funny egg.
She'd like us to believe that, but that, you're right, that's not true.
I'll tell you a really quick story, and I'm not going to tell all of them because I want people to buy the book.
It's, by all means.
Enough getting books sold. But there was a comedian who told me a story about Joan getting started. And she worked in a department store with Lou Alexander's wife. And so one day his wife came home. He said, "This girl I work with wants to get into comedy. Can you come and talk to her?" And Lou wasn't, you know, headlining or anything then. He was starting out himself, but he was more advanced. So he came and talked to Joan. And the best advice he gave her was, you have to get out there. Get in front of an audience. You won't get paid, but, you know, just find a stage. So a couple weeks go by, and Joan contacts him and his wife and says, I forget where, the Bitter End or somewhere. She said, "I'm going to be on. Will you come and watch and tell me what you think?" So he comes, and you think Joan Rivers talks fast, or she did. Near the end of her life, she was like a bullet train in the beginning. So Lou tells her, he said, "You know, you had some funny material, but you have to slow down. You have to say, you know, before you get to the punchline, you have to go 1, 2, 3, punchline."
Right.
So Joan goes, "Okay, I have it." You know, and she says, "Will you come back next week?" So he comes back, and she's up on stage, and she's telling, you know, the story. And then she says out loud, 1, 2, 3, and goes, "Punchline." And,
Joan.
So everybody had a learning curve. And you know, she was really proud of herself and said, "How did I do?" And Lou just, you know, he had his head in his lap going, "You don't say it out loud."
See, the comedians today, they have it so easy with because comedy is so accessible. Stand-up comedy is so accessible right now, you know, with YouTube, that the clubs almost become unnecessary. And, like, it's hard to sell books right now. It's hard to sell tickets to comedy shows right now because, you know, if somebody wants to see my 10-minute act, they can Google me and see it and not have to pay the, you know, the $50 that they'd spend for the entire night. Don't do that. I'm funny on stage. But, you know, tell me a little bit about the demise of the clubs because, you know, just as I was about old enough to become a key holder, the clubs were closing, and I really feel like I missed out on something. Can you tell me a little bit about how it came about that the clubs started to disappear?
Well, you know, you have to admit they lasted probably longer than almost any club that you could think of.
Right.
You know, they lasted. The last one closed in 1988, and they opened in 1960. So, you know, 28 years, a long, long run, and they probably should have closed down a little bit earlier than that. They were cool and hip during the 60s and probably half of the 70s. You know, they were the place that people like Tony Bennett and Sinatra would go just to hang out.
Right.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You know, that you had people running them like Tony Roma and, you know, all these great musicians and Arnie Morton and just fabulous people. And they were cool and hip and sophisticated, and businessmen would go there for their martini lunch meetings, and then they'd bring their, you know, wives back on Saturday or their girlfriends. So they were really a cool place. As a matter of fact, John Lennon, when the Beatles came to New York for their big Ed Sullivan show, they were told, you know, anywhere in New York you want to go. And John Lennon said, there's nowhere that Cynthia and I, his then wife, want to go other than the Playboy Club. You know, we've heard about this place. So it was that kind of place. But the times changed. You know, disco came. You know, the bunnies were where they were scandalous in the 60s. You know, the girls coming to the clubs in the late 70s were wearing less than the bunnies. You know, so. But so the times changed, really, and you know, they lost their clientele, and you know, like many things, they had a good run. They had a terrific run. London, they had a casino, and Playboy was used to burning through money. They made so much money, and I think that was their downfall. You know, Hefner, from the time he came out with that first issue in '54. They were rolling in money. So, you know, meeting deadlines for the magazine and having to pay extra to go over deadline was no big deal. A losing club was no big deal because the other clubs were making money.
Right.
But it caught up with them, and the times changed. That was the long answer to what is basically.
That's exactly the answer I was looking for, Patty. The concept of the Playboy Club in 21st century mentality is, oh, isn't that quaint? The girls wear cute little outfits, and the comedians are all in tuxedos. You know, and on one hand, people are like, oh, Mad Men, I love that stuff. But on the other, it's as quaint as walking down the first part of Disneyland.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. You know, it was the cocktail generation, and, you know, we're all drinking sparkling water now, so.
But it is, the reason why I think my listeners should get this book is because it's such a fascinating view into a time that shapes the culture that we're in right now. You know, we talk about civil rights, and it's not, the irony is not lost on me that I'm reading, you know, the chapter about integrating the blind integration of the club while I'm watching the Charlottesville riots, demonstrations,
exactly.
Whatever.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, Mad Men was one of the hottest shows on TV, and it directly reflects this period that, the only thing that's going to save us from ourselves right now is the intelligence of the satire that is reflected not only in the stand-up comedy, and here's my transition, Patty, but also the cartoons that were that were part of Playboy. And you spend half the book talking about the master cartoons that are in this book and the incredibly talented group of cartoonists who created entire pages and joke panels and things like that. Hef clearly loved cartoons, and if I remember right, was an aspiring cartoonist himself. Is that right?
He was. He wanted to make his living as a cartoonist, and from the time he was a young kid, like in grade school, that's how he journaled. He made cartoons of himself doing everyday mundane things, And they graduated to, you know, Hef talking to girls and, you know, funny little quips like that. So he thought he'd make a living editing and was work around and really didn't have much success. 1951, he came out with a comic book, a full 74-page comic book, which I've read through many times. And it was good. It was funny. He just wasn't good enough to compete with, you know, the Al Jaffes and the Arnie Roths and the Jack Coles that were prevalent in those days. You had these artists, you know, that were doing this work. So
right.
He turned his attention to coming out with a women's magazine and building an empire. So maybe it was for the better. I don't know. But his genius has always been hiring the very best people.
Man,
people like Jack Cole.
Yeah, I mean, there. We'll talk about Jack in just a second. You caught my comic in 1951, right?
51, yeah.
Okay, now, you know, we recently had the biographer of Harvey Kurtzman mm-hmm. on the show, who, as we all know, published was the again of Mad Magazine, progressive, come out till a year later. I would imagine they're pretty similar. And Harvey Kurtzman and Hef had a partnership for a while.
Right. Well, Harvey drew for the magazine,
right?
And then at one point, Hef again visited the idea of having his own comic magazine, and had Harvey asked him to put together a group of artists, cartoonists. And what did Harvey do? But he raided Mad Magazine. He took all of the top Mad artists, the cartoonists, with him for this magazine called Trump.
Yep. everybody can make your own jokes right now.
There you go. But needless to say, the folks at MAD were not really happy.
No, Gaines was not happy at all.
No. And Al Jaffe, needing a job later on, actually went back and he himself on their mercy and said, I need a job. And they obviously took Al back. But the magazine, unfortunately, only made it to two issues. Times were changing. TV was becoming big. And a lot of advertisers were switching from, and print ad financing got tight. So Hefner, in a famous quote, they asked him why he folded the magazine. And he said he gave Harvey an unlimited budget, and he surpassed it. So
very Hef and very Harvey both.
Right. And I love all these little... Hef asked Harvey at one time, he said, well, what cartoonists are you lining up? And he said, the usual gang of idiots.
Right.
And that was what they were collectively known at as, you know, these great cartoonists, you know, Al Jaffe, Arnie Roth, Jules Feist.
I mean, and all of those guys, so far from idiots. They're all brilliant. You know, we were talking before we recorded Bobby London, one of the Dirty Duck for Playboy, and Dirty Duck now, if the rumor is true, is getting a prestige format. Plug something else in your book. By all means, get Patty's book, please.
And what is the name of it?
We don't know yet.
Playboy Laughs, mine.
Oh, yours, yes. Playboy Laughs is, yes. And oh. Let's see.
Let's on the cartoons. I love the cartoons.
I do too. Let's talk about Jack for a second. Let's talk about Cole. Jack Cole, Golden Age comic book artist, brilliant cartoonist, wickedly funny, and if I remember right, one of Hef's closest friends.
Yep.
who was a contributor to Mad but had kind of a dark side.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Jack for a bit.
Yeah, they, as was typical with Hef, he became friendly with a lot of people. You know, it worked both ways. Either they were his friends and ended up working on the magazine, or they worked, you know, on the magazine or the TV show and became good friends. You know, if in the early years, if you went to the Chicago Playboy offices, you'd find people just like, you know, Johnny Mathis or Shel Silverstein, you know, just hanging out in the office because they were in town and it was a cool place to hang out. But with Jack, they became friendly, and actually Jack and his wife moved from New York to Chicago because he was doing so much work for Playboy. We did lose him way too young.
Yes, way too young.
Yeah, that was disappointing and sad.
And you know, that's, I think there's more to be said about that, but I don't think this is the time or place. But one of the most brilliant in the field of brilliant cartoonists that have come through Playboy, and there are, I mean, this is the A-list. There's Arnie Roth, who was just jazz on paper. He was incredible.
Oh my gosh. And to sit down with Arnie like I did, I got to hang out with him and Carolyn, his wife, for a couple days, and just hysterical. Yeah, and I think the cartoonists are funny people, where the comics, I don't think they're funny people. And one of the singers told me, I don't know if you know Julie Budd, but she's a singer, but she started out as one of those 12-year-old prodigies, you
right.
know, the mini girl with the maxi voice. And she put it very succinctly. She said, comedians are very peculiar.
And yes, we are.
And she kept saying peculiar. And she said they were not a laugh a minute, you know, if you had breakfast with them, which she traveled with them. And she said they were just very peculiar. Whereas I think that the cartoonists are irreverent and funny, and they're always, you know, thinking up things while you're talking to them. You just say, okay, I'm ready for it, Arnie. Hit me with it. They were very funny people.
Yeah, they really are. What I've discovered from talking to cartoonists is they are the thoughtful side and the funny side of comedians, with the focus that a lot of comedians lack, and without the very tortured soul.
That's very insightful. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, they never want to stop working. I saw Al Jaffe.
Who's what, 94, right?
96.
Wow.
And still working for Mad. He's still doing, I was hanging out in his studio, and he was working on a fold-in for the upcoming issue.
Good for him. And congratulations to Bill Morrison for being named editor-in-chief of Mad Magazine,
yeah.
By the way. What a tremendous torch you've been handed. You can't talk about cartoons and publishing and comics, really, without talking about someone who I believe is a friend of Hef's as well, Stan Lee, who I believe
right.
you talked to in this book. Can you tell me about Stan's insights?
I did not get to talk
okay.
to Stan, but, you know, of course, did a lot of research and knew about him, and he worked for the magazine, of course. You know, all the great people. Hefner did not have, you know, anybody subpar just to fill the pages. He had Leroy Neiman drew cartoons for Playboy, and his artwork's hanging in museums worth millions and millions of dollars now, and Shel Silverstein and Al Pfeiffer. You
right.
know, I was talking to Al, and as we were wrapping up, I had forgotten, or maybe I didn't even know, but he said, I got all my best ideas for Carnal Knowledge from the Playboy Mansion, hanging out at the Playboy Mansion. And I'm like, holy, you know what?
Right.
I didn't even know he wrote Carnal Knowledge.
You can say whatever you want in here. It's not a family show. It's okay.
Oh, my mother will tune in and, you know.
Hi, Mom. Your daughter wrote a great book. Playboy Laughs. Get it wherever good books are sold. And, of course, you can't talk about illustration in Playboy without talking about the master, Vargas.
Oh, wow. Wasn't that something?
Yeah.
I mean, talk about a friendship, and I don't know who helped who more.
The Vargas girl and Playboy are as synonymous as Playboy in the centerfold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just is part of what the I can't even remember the last time a Vargas illustration ran in Playboy, but it's just so much a part of it. You know, it's like sugar and Coca-Cola. They just exist together.
Absolutely. And in the book with the cartoonists, they were all great, and they gave me artwork to put in the book. So I was able to show a lot of their artwork. And the Vargas family gave me a photograph, a sketch, a preliminary sketch that Alberto did. And it just illustrated what a micromanager Hef was, because this a sketch had Hef's handwritten notes on it. And this happened with all the cartoonists, all but Arnie Roth. Arnie said he would not be edited. But this is back pre-internet days. And
so they're mailing Alberto, this back and forth.
They were mailing it. Can you believe that? Alberto would do a sketch in California, put it in an envelope, address it, put a stamp on it, mail it to Chicago. Hef would look at it, make his little comments, and they were minute comments. I mean, he was the picture in the dictionary of a micromanager, you know, like, oh, she needs, you know, one more eyelash and, you know, this and that. And then he'd write the comments and put it back in an envelope, address it, stamp it, send it back to Alberto. He'd make the corrections back again to Chicago. So, and this went on every single month with every single cartoon. It was, I don't know how Hefner had time to pay attention to the centerfolds and the editorials and everything else.
Oh, he made time.
I thought he was doing other stuff.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of that is the mystique. And I mean, Hef is such a force of nature. You know, that whole Playboy lifestyle is just so mind-blowing, you know?
Yeah, the grotto, and you haven't gotten to it yet, so I won't ruin it, but a bunch of the cartoonists were at the mansion, and typically there is the grotto is underground. It's an underground bar where you look out, and the girls swim by typically naked.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to ruin it for you, but the cartoonists didn't quite get the hang of it. So I'll leave it at that. I want to hear from you when you get to that part.
You know what? You'll probably hear from me this afternoon, Patty. This is a fantastic mirror of late 20th century American culture. Hef is responsible for changing the way that America thinks. And a lot of what we were dealing with today is a snowball kicked down the mountain by one guy in Chicago. And if you are a fan of comedy, if you are a fan of culture, if you are a fan of even politics and recent American history, Playboy Laughs is a book that you should pick up right now. It's available wherever great books are sold. Patty, are you doing signings or anything like that anywhere? Are you going to be anywhere?
I am. I'm doing. They're bouncing me back and forth across the country. I am in Washington State right now, but 2 days ago I was in New York, out in the Hamptons, doing a book signing. So I don't even know my schedule, but I think I'm in Barnes & Noble in New York in a couple weeks. But anywhere that books are sold, they should be there. And if you go in and they tell you it's not there, ask them why it's not there. It should be.
Do you have a website, Patty?
I do, patty-farmer.com, not to be confused with another author who is named Patty Farmer, so make sure you get that hyphen in there.
Patty-Farmer. The book, again, Playboy Laughs. It is available wherever you get your books sold. I get a stack of stuff every week, and I have my choice of guests. And when this book came across my desk, I said, yes, this, and fell in love with this book in the first chapter. You will, too. Playboy Laughs, wherever books are sold. Get it, and then go to patty-farmer.com and tell her how much you loved it, because you will, promise. And that's it. Patty, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. I can't believe how fast the time went chatting with you.
I can't either. Believe me, I could go all day about this stuff, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, when you think about Hefner and how the world would have been different if he had been a successful cartoonist, he probably would have just been a family man drawing cartoons, and we never would have this Playboy empire and the contribution to the culture, really.
Yeah, man, that's the truth. That's the truth, and that's what's reflected in this book. So check it out and get it today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.